Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and on today's show, Representative Jason Chaffetz gets an earful from local residents. Outdoor retailers step up their threat of leaving Utah in protest of the state's stance on federal public lands, while state lawmakers issue a challenge of their own to Utah National Monuments. And at the legislature, rape kit testing, election reforms, and building a state reserve of gold and silver. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Thanks for being here, Matt.
Happy to be here.
Government Editor Dan Harry is here as well. Welcome, Dan.
Good morning.
Health, Education, and Environment Editor Tony Semerad joins us via the phone. Tony, thanks to you as well.
Hi there.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke is here in studio. Good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning.
And you can join this conversation as well during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us up at 801-355-8255. That's 355-TALK. I think it makes sense to begin with the raucous, loud, chaotic, contentious town hall meeting that took place last night at Brighton High School. Representative Jason Chaffetz is in town. He faced a not very sympathetic crowd. Matt Canham, what was this event about? Tell us about the turnout and what happened at this town hall.
Well, this started as just the idea of a normal town hall that members of Congress do on a regular basis. And Jason Chaffetz picked a time where there was a lot of political upheaval. It spread mostly through Facebook, through resistance groups, is what they're calling themselves, to President Donald Trump. And it was pretty clear pretty quickly that he was going to get a crowd that was going to be hostile. They moved it to a larger venue. It was not large enough. So Brighton High School's auditorium had about 1,000 seats. According to reporter Courtney Tanner, who was there, there was about 1,500 people standing outside that never got in.
1,500 people. Wow. Had they considered moving it again by any chance? I mean, to a large, but what would be the
I don't think they did, yeah. So there was about 1,500 people who couldn't get in. It was really intense. I think they tried to get bigger. It didn't really work out. They were angry. They were angry outside. They were angry inside. And he heard it the entire 75 minutes he was there.
I was going to say that those who did get inside had some questions for Chaffetz when they could be heard. And maybe we can tackle a little bit of what was asked and how he responded. There was more than one question in between a lot of yelling and booing about his role as chairman of the House Oversight Committee, right?
Right. There were questions about whether they were going to investigate Donald Trump and his potential conflicts of interest. There were questions about public lands and the new Bears Ears National Monument. His answers were hard to hear because he got shouted down every time he started to talk. He kept asking for time to explain himself. But Congressman Chaffetz is a little bit mischievous. He also tried to prod them a few times by pointing out that he thought his vote for Donald Trump was the right one, knowing what kind of reaction he would get at that point. So this was one more about what questions were asked. His answers were hard to hear.
There was even some, I was following this on Twitter and watching the Salt Lake Tribune's live feed of it on Facebook. And there were a few tweets suggesting that maybe Chaffetz was baiting the audience because he called out, Vice President Mike Pence's name, Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, asking for applause for these people. But that didn't obviously happen.
I mean, the hard part is he does believe in those things. He is a Republican member of Congress. So him just saying what he believes would have baited that crowd.
Right.
So I don't know if that's necessarily the case, though I do think he had a little bit more fun with it when it got to the point where he realized an actual back and forth was not likely. You know, he did defend the decisions he has made to not vigorously go after questions of conflicts of interest, saying that the president is exempt from certain conflicts of interest law. He did, however, point out that yesterday he signed on to a letter asking for an investigation into Kellyanne Conway, who's one of Donald Trump's chief counselors, when Kellyanne Conway on TV plugged Ivanka Trump's fashion line, which it goes against some ethics rules.
Right.
So he said, look, he tried to portray himself as independent, but he's been criticized in not only in that room, but elsewhere for not vigorously looking into Donald Trump the way he has looked into Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama.
What is, I mean, his one of his responses to that, and I'm putting words here in his mouth, I'm not certain if this is exactly correct, but that this isn't the purview of the House Oversight Committee to be conducting that kind of an investigation. Is that his response?
What he's saying is that his job is to oversee or to look into the federal government, but if a law exempts the president, then what is he supposed to do there? You know, now, I think there's people who have very, you know, legitimate points on both sides of that one that could say that there are lots of things you can look into. Donald Trump has a hotel a few blocks from the White House that he manages, but is actually owned by the federal government. He is in violation of his lease because the lease says the owner cannot be an employee of the federal government. He is the president. So that's something that Jason Chaffetz could be more aggressive into looking into. He has asked for the details of the lease, which is the smallest possible step forward, but that he hasn't vigorously looked into that.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners that we invite you to join this conversation. Were you at this town hall last night? Why did you go? Did you get the answers you wanted or convey the message that you wanted to convey? Call us at 801-355-8255. You can also comment at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Matt, you mentioned the kind of quick organizing done by activist groups, maybe some disparate messages being sent there. I'm kind of wondering if anybody has seen a town hall quite like this in the past. Robert Gerke or Dan Harry, either of you have experience with something quite as contentious.
Well, I think it's all very reminiscent of what we saw with the Tea Party, the rise of the Tea Party years ago. And you remember at that time there were people going to town hall meetings and shouting down senators and representatives. Not as much here, because I think the only one that had a town hall scheduled in that period of time was Jim Matheson, and I think he canceled it. But, you know, and you're seeing this again across the country. A lot of the congressmen who have town halls scheduled are postponing them or finding other things to be doing at that period of time. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of anger out there, and I'm not sure. Obviously, we saw that vented last night toward Jason Chaffetz. I'm not sure it's actually productive in the sense that, you know, I don't think Jason Chaffetz left that meeting any more or less, you know, entrenched in his beliefs. But, you know, I guess these people did have an opportunity to make themselves heard, if nothing else, and so there's maybe some benefit in that.
But hard to say exactly what the effect might be on Chaffetz himself, on the congressman himself.
Well, I mean, as we saw with the Tea Party, is that, you know, that the only comparison there, it didn't really change people's minds. It just created a lot of uproar and furor, and then the change happens at the ballot box. But we've got to wait a long time and see if that energy can be sustained for 2 years until midterm elections.
Dan Harry.
I will say that in the Tea Party situation, I think in 2010 is where we saw this, it really started to congeal around opposition to Obamacare, to the Affordable Care Act. And so that became sort of a theme that resonated with those who were resisting the administration and the establishment. In the case we saw last night, I'm not sure you saw any resonating themes there. You know, this is a nationwide tactic that they're saying, look, the Tea Party was very effective. Here's how they did it. We're going to use these same tactics. But on the other hand, I think that unless you have some unifying message, it's very hard for that to have a lasting impact.
Organizing around one topic. The Affordable Care Act was, though, one of the efforts by Republicans to repeal the Affordable Care Act was brought up
quite a bit
last night. Any other, Matt Canham, any other sort of highlights from the 75 minutes at this town hall worth recounting?
You know, I think the one thing I would like to say on this is that, you know, there's a debate over whether these kind of tactics work or not. And it's not a, you know, one shot and you see an outcome. But even one thing that was brought up, that Jason Chaffetz brought up, is he pulled back a bill that he'd been sponsoring for years that would sell off federal land, about 3.3 million acres over a series of states. There was actually land identified under the Clinton administration that could be disposed of. There was a huge outcry of opposition from a variety of people, from environmentalists to hunters, and he withdrew that legislation. That's a sign that some, you know, public activism and public outcry can influence members of Congress, and it clearly does. So, you know, whether, you know, I take Robert's point that whether this exact, you know, town hall and the tactics used at this town hall had the effect it wanted. Public influence on politicians is, you know, is something that, you know, actually happens regularly, and this is a sign of something that could be the start of something. But as Dan pointed out, it needs to have an organizing structure to it, which could take place over the next little while. We'll just have to see.
Concerted and ongoing action, I guess, on the part of people, as Dan is saying, is what the Tea Party did and what could be we could be seeing happening here. Matt, we mentioned, actually I'm not certain that we mentioned, but questions that Chaffetz received at this meeting related to the president's executive order on immigration and refugees. The day before this town hall, in downtown Salt Lake City, Chaffetz met with representatives from Utah's Muslim community. This was at a law firm downtown. What happened at this meeting?
Chaffetz apparently likes to go in front of groups that are hostile, and has done so a couple times this week. Now, to be more serious, Jason Chaffetz over the last couple of years has met with Utah's Muslims. He's gone to mosques. He's talked to them. He's tried to have some outreach, and this is part of that. Khosrow Samnani, an Iranian American who is very prominent in our community, is a developer, has kind of brokered these interactions, and so this meeting happened at Khosrow's office. And there was a group of Muslim leaders, some of whom are very active in the Democratic Party, who were invited to talk to him about Donald Trump's recent immigration and refugees orders, which are now being held up by courts.
Right.
And Chaffetz, you know, he didn't back down. He did say, you know, that he thinks that these were the right countries, that, you know, there were a group of seven countries, including Iraq and Syria, that should be looked at, that there should be increased ways to vet these refugees. But he also said that we should allow these refugees at some point. So he said that he will reserve judgment on how this actually works going forward, but that he does think that we should have some refugees and immigration from these areas.
And he spoke also to, you know, Utah history, the Mormon migration and Mormons' own persecution in the United States of America, equating the Muslim experience to the Mormon experience.
Right, and that's something very unique about the state of Utah and the way that this issue plays within the politics of the state, because that Mormon experience is still felt very strongly here. It's one of the primary reasons that Senator Mike Lee said he didn't vote for Donald Trump. It's a primary reason that Governor Gary Herbert was the one Republican governor who said that he would accept Syrian refugees when there were other Republican governors were questioning whether that was a good idea or not. So it's clearly part of our culture and our politics that is more willing to accept refugees from these areas. That said, there are still people who are concerned about the security, someone like Representative Chris Stewart, and in this case, Jason Chaffetz as well. He kind of is the middle ground of saying more security, but we need to let them in at some point.
I'm curious about, you know, you mentioned the executive order having a hard time or being still suspended in the courts. What are other members, particularly Mike Lee, saying about this? I know that he said he was watching this closely. You mentioned Chris Stewart. You've talked about Jason
right.
Chaffetz. But Mike Lee has had his own response to these orders.
So Mike Lee had his own town hall on Monday. It was online, where it allows him to screen what questions come in and make it far less acrimonious than what we saw with Jason Chaffetz. But he got a question about this as well. Mike Lee is a lawyer and a constitutional scholar, and he went into all kinds of wonky court talk. But when you strip that out, what he said was that he believes that there is a legal underpinning for what Donald Trump is trying to do and that the court should find it legal. Now, he also has said that he's had some technical questions about it, which is a sign that he doesn't necessarily agree with everything that's going on here. But he hasn't outright criticized what Donald Trump's wanting to do here either. So he's kind of played a little bit of a middle ground.
Yeah, I think that that's very notable about our congressional delegation. They really have not come out in criticism of this. And, you know, that's sort of surprising given the culture and the attitude. We talked about the LDS history here. I think they've got some leeway to distance themselves from the president here, and they would be, you know, in sync with the public. But they've chosen not to do that.
Is that I don't know what the reason might be there, but obviously they have a wish list of things that they want to see accomplished.
Yeah.
Maybe working with the administration and not getting on the wrong side of it could be part of that.
That's I think what's going on. They don't want to to alienate the administration right out the bat.
Robert Gerke, several members of our congressional delegation appear to be walking a kind of fine line on this particular issue. Any comments?
Yeah, I think Dan's right. I think they are trying to play nice and kind of extend President Trump's honeymoon as long as it can go. But they are taking some heat for it, and I think if that continues and if that spills over into other issues, perhaps, you could see it change. It's worth noting, probably, that the Muslim ban that Trump initiated is, according to polls, popular especially among Republican voters. And so, while there is this uproar over, from the left and from Democratic voters, their base is behind this issue.
Well, but there still has to be a difference between, I would imagine, a Mormon Republican voter and the Republican Party at large.
Yeah, and it will be kind of interesting to watch. I mean, the church did issue a statement on this, but it was a little bit tepid. I would, if they were to take a stronger stance, you might see some shifts among the Mormon electorate and maybe consequently the elected officials. But right now, I think they're just they're on a team, and this team is maybe having a little bit of a tough go of it the first few weeks of the administration, and they're trying to be supportive of that.
Okay. Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke there. We are going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will turn to the Outdoor Industry Association and its move to pressure state leaders on public lands policy. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a minute.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Dr. Paul Schmidt, internal medicine at the Budge Clinic, health services including diabetes management, weight loss, and nutritional guidance. Office hours and appointment information available at 435-716-1980.
Our Thistle Radio music stream is packed with classic tracks from across five decades of music from Celtic roots, along with the emerging sounds, of course, but it's the classics we're after this week, so we've poached an hour's worth from the Thistle Radio playlist. Join me to hear it all on your radio on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Join us tonight at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, Government Editor Dan Harry, Art, Education, and Environment Editor Tony Semerad, and columnist Robert Gerke. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Let's now take a look at what seems like an old story with new legs, the Outdoor Industry Association, which hosts the biannual Outdoor Retailers Show here in Salt Lake City, is saying that it's time to leave Utah. Tony Semerad, this is all about the stance that Utah leaders have taken on public lands. Tell us about this story.
Well, this was a rolling story all this week, basically flowing out of Gary Herbert's decision on Friday to sign a resolution calling for the Bears Ears National Monument to be rescinded. And as you recall, late in Obama's term, he created this national monument to be managed by Native American groups, about 1.35 million acres. Pristine, valued land to Native Americans and others in southern Utah. So on Monday, organizers of the Outdoor Retailer Show, this twice yearly convention in Salt Lake, brings about 45,000 visitors, estimated about $40 million annual contribution to the state's economy. The organizers announced that they're going out for a kind of a wider spread of bids from Utah and other states for possible venues to host this show and potentially move it out of Utah. And they're you know, making it very clear that this reflects discontent with Utah's land policies. The executive director of the Outdoor Industry Association, which is very closely tied to the show's owner, you know, saying this flows from public lands policies and lots of complaints among people attending the show, the industry bigs, that this is kind of incompatible with their industry and their views.
I know that you're talking about the head of the industry association there. I know that former Black Diamond Equipment CEO Peter Metcalf has called for this move in the past. Now the clothing company Patagonia says that if this event comes back to Utah, they won't participate. Yvonne Chouinard, that company's CEO, called specifically for the state to support the Bears Ears National Monument and to stop a lawsuit, an ongoing lawsuit that it has, to take control of federal public lands. What is the governor's response been to these requests from industry association people?
Yeah, well, there was a kind of a snowballing effect after this announcement that they were going out for RFPs on possible other venues. You know, Patagonia, which had been part of the initial call, you know, to move away, said it was going to boycott the show. There's been another company, a Canadian-based company, I believe Arc'teryx is how you say it, has also announced it will boycott the show. And, you know, by Thursday, Governor Herbert was, used part of his press availability to kind of, punch back a little bit, basically saying that the industry had kind of gotten Utah's stance wrong, that the state does a lot for the outdoor industry, and at one point even kind of called it a political ploy. And, you know, he's seeking to kind of dial it down a little bit, calling for less kind of dialogue in the media and maybe some sort of a sit down with senior members of this group. But he's clearly kind of on the back heel about this and seeking to kind of mend some fences.
A quick reminder to our listeners that we want to hear your thoughts on these stories. What would the loss of outdoor retailer the show mean to you? Are you pleased? Are you bothered with the industry flexing its muscle? Call us at 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. One quick comment from Barnaby at sltrib.com. He says, they say, I hope the outdoor retailers do leave the Salt Palace in protest of the environmental degradation by the government and especially Utah's governing body and wake some of the people up. Money talks, BS walks. That's a comment at sltrib.com on this. And, you know, I mentioned the lawsuit that the state has on public lands. Is this something that the state is still pursuing, or might they go another route given the new administration in Washington that might be friendlier to their sort of demands for public lands initiatives? Robert Gerke.
Yeah, I think they haven't filed the lawsuit. There's some pressure. They're turning some of the House Republicans who have been sort of the masterminds of this have been trying to turn up the heat on the attorney general and the governor to pull the trigger on it because they're the ones who have to do that. So they are moving in that direction. And I think when it looked like Hillary Clinton might win the presidency and get to appoint Supreme Court justices, now that we've got Neil Gorsuch is the nominee and it could tilt the balance of the Supreme Court back to a Republican, I think it gives them more incentive rather than less to proceed on this, because, you know, if it was looking like there was a 5-4 liberal court, they probably would have shelved the thing for a few more years. Now that it looks like it's going to move to the right, that they feel like this is a better opportunity than otherwise would be. I think there is still interest in the lawsuit. There's been some sort of fracturing, I think, in the coalition of other states that have when they've been trying to line up other states to do this, and you've seen the attorneys general from numbers of those states raising questions about the validity and the potential for success. But I think they are still heading in that direction. And we saw, you know, even with the threats from the outdoor retail groups, we still see these bills, these resolutions on the Bears Ears and on the Grand Staircase,
right,
moving forward in the state legislature. So the governor and legislative leaders say that they don't want to be blackmailed or pressured or threatened into changing policies for the state of Utah. And so we're at a bit of an impasse, aren't we?
Dan, Harry, we mentioned the resolution on the Bears' ears that the governor signed. That as Robert Gierke just mentioned, there's another resolution making its way through the legislature. Maybe it's already done. I'm not certain. Having to do with the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and the effort is to shrink the boundaries.
Yeah, it's to re-examine it and reassess and possibly shrink the boundaries.
And what is the status of that resolution?
Yeah, it's gone through the legislature.
I'm waiting for the governor's signature.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, listeners, you can join this conversation with your phone calls, 801-355-8255, or comment at sltrib.com. I want to circle back around to Jason Chaffetz, because Matt Canham earlier brought up the successful efforts that some people involved actually in the outdoor industry, I think hunting groups and others, had to convince Chaffetz to back off his resurrected plans to, as you said, dispose of something like 3 million acres. This is disposal in this instance means, I guess, sale of lands. And does that, I don't know, bode well for conservationists looking to see the state stop doing what it's doing, who are flexing their muscle right now? Or is that does that not play into this? Who wants to address that?
I would be skeptical. I mean, that disposal of the excess lands bill, I think, had been introduced several years in a row and really hadn't gone anywhere. So I think it was a symbolic thing that Representative Chaffetz withdrew that. But on other very substantive public lands fronts, I don't see any backing off at all. Just the opposite is true, especially with Representative Rob Bishop in a position of power on natural resources. And he is very influential, and he is very much a part of the movement to assert state control. And he is not a great friend of environmentalists or conservationists. I think that we're going to continue going down that road.
Okay. Well, going back then to the Outdoor Retailers Convention, where Tony Semerat, maybe you can address this, where might it go?
Well, you know, that branches into some complex issues. One of, Salt Lake City's strong cards, of course, is proximity to a lot of these wonderful recreation venues. So in any kind of bidding process, Salt Lake comes in pretty strong. However, you know, Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado is making noises that, Colorado would just be, quote-unquote, better for this kind of thing. There are, other kind of regional venues that might be in play, but it's hard to say. And you know, it's important to stress that this is not a promise to leave. This is, just the organizers saying, hey, we're going to look at our options and see if we can't come up with a better fit.
How about convention organizers? I know the Salt Lake, Visit Salt Lake, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, was interviewed in the Salt Lake Tribune article on this. What was their response to this?
Well, they're constitutionally upbeat people, right? They're very kind of confident about Salt Lake's position. I think Scott Beck's direct quote was, we sort of welcome this RFP. We do very well in these requests for proposals. But, there's no doubt that this would be a financial blow, and if were it to leave. It's a growing industry, and that's kind of an upward trajectory in terms of economic return for the state. So they're putting a good face on it. They're basically expressing optimism that they would do well in an RFP, but clearly they're concerned.
Okay. Well, as we said, an industry flexing its muscle, and $40 million of money that is coming from this convention that's estimated, according to some reports, that could go away as a result of this. I guess my final question is the governor's office or the state sweating that part of this a little bit?
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are.
Okay. All right, Tony Semerad, thank you very much for that reporting. I want to turn now to the annual process of churning out legislation and amending state code that takes place more or less from the time of the first inversion until St. Patrick's Day. You'll have to consult your liturgical calendars for that one. The Utah State Legislature is wrapping up its third week, and Dan Harry, government editor, we've gone over some of the things that are happening up there already, the passage of resolutions attacking national monuments in the state. There's a lot of legislation that's going through this year. I'm not sure where to begin. How about one that seems like a bit of an oddity, the a measure to have the state keep some of its savings in precious metals. This is a measure by Representative Ken Ivory. What is this about?
Yeah, this is a continuation of a move that actually Robert covered quite well in the legislature. And it, first, the state now has a law that recognizes gold and silver as legal tender. So if you feel, you know, inclined to pay off your property taxes or any of your other taxes with gold and silver, you're certainly welcome to do that now. There's also kind of an industry that's a cottage industry that they hope to build around this that would have repositories for this these precious metal commodities, and then they would use certificates that you could spend like money. And I think that's what Ken Ivory has in theory here. He wants to push the idea that you can the state can invest in these certificates.
Are there other states that do something? I mean, I don't, maybe this isn't in the reporting, but that do anything like this around the United States? Does anybody know?
I don't think so. I mean, I think most states, generally speaking, are pretty conservative with their public investments, and so this would be a departure. I know in the past, the treasurer's office has not been real comfortable with the push to, you know, incorporate gold into their holdings. I don't know. Did the treasurer this time take it?
I don't think the treasurer has weighed in on this as yet. The bill actually came to committee the other day but didn't pass. They debated it for a while but didn't vote on it.
Held, I think, on the on the sponsor's request. One person who testified, though, was Overstock.com CEO Jonathan Johnson, whose company, Overstock.com, is involved in not hoarding, but putting away gold themselves.
Stockpiling. They stockpile gold because there is a concern that Jonathan has that if the market collapses, he wants to be able to continue to pay his employees. And so they have a reserve of gold that I guess, I can't remember, I think it was 2 months' worth of operational expenses that they would that they keep in these hard assets. And so you know, he's been a supporter of this. A lot of the people who are concerned about, you know, sort of the potential collapse of the U.S. currency are big on gold and have been pushing in this direction. I mean, it's sort of the big selling point, right, is that while the dollar fluctuates, gold fluctuates as well, but they say there's inherent intrinsic value in gold and they can and if the dollar collapses, they'll be sitting on a gold mine, so to speak.
Right. Well, literally. Well, gold coins seem to have a particular fascination here in the Beehive State, and as the John Swallow trial makes its way through, we'll talk more about that. But for the moment, we are actually going to have to take another quick break here on Behind the Headlines. When we come back, we will stick with the legislative session and also hear a little bit about the first week of the John Swallow trial. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment.
I'm John Kovash, Utah Public Radio correspondent for Moab in Southeast Utah. If you have comments, questions, or ideas for stories for any of us at the station, please visit our website at upr.org or call 1-800-826-1495. You can also share your ideas with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Be sure to include the hashtag IMUPR. Thanks for listening.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
it's a Valentine's Day special with love songs from Brazil, Ireland, France, Nigeria, and Australia.
You say that your love was just for me.
I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Love Songs Around the World, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, and Tony Semerad. You can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Before the break, we were talking about the legislative session and a measure to try and have precious metals be stockpiled, that's not the word, but used in the state's reserves. And maybe we'll turn to some other things that are happening up at the legislature, and in particular, election changes to election law or updates to election law that were discussed this week on the Hill. And one of those has to do with presidential elections, a response maybe to long lines seen during the caucuses and in the general election this past November. Dan Harry, what is the proposed fix?
Yeah, the proposed fix is that the state holds a statewide presidential primary. And the last year, as you remember, there were not presidential primaries in the state. They had caucuses that were run by the parties. And as, especially on the Democratic side, you saw long lines of people trying to cast their ballot. And it was kind of a mess. It was a sort of a joyous mess because Democrats felt so emboldened and empowered by the fact that they saw so many of their neighbors turning out to vote in the presidential election. Bernie Sanders had a lot to do with that. It was a lot of excitement. And so now they said, you know, that's really not a way to run an election. We need to do it so it's more efficient. People aren't waiting in lines for hours. So let's have the state have this as an obligation like they do other elections.
And this would be so a primary, presidential primary that would be for both Democrats and
right.
Republicans alike?
So you would pick one ballot and vote on that ballot, yeah.
What do Democratic and Republican state leaders say about this idea?
I think the biggest hang-up for that is potentially the cost. I think the price tag on that is about $3 million. And so when you get down to the price tag, that's where the rubber hits the road in the legislature. They'll pass a lot of these bills with fiscal notes on them, and then they'll hold them until the end of the session, and then they do their prioritization. And you know, if it's not something that the Republican majority wants to go along with, he usually doesn't make the cut.
Well, Republican Party Chair James Evans spoke in favor of the bill, but said that if the money came through, they might not end up using it because they might not enact a
yeah,
primary.
So that questions whether Republicans really want to get behind that effort. Do they want to spend $3 million in state money in something that the Republican Party's not going to participate in? So.
Well, there's also a bill requiring county clerks to pay the postage cost of mail-in ballots and also to notify voters if their ballots were invalidated by a county clerk's office.
Spoiled ballots, they call them. And so, you know, they on the mail-in ballots, they check your signature to see if it matches what they have on record there. And if it looks like it doesn't, those are considered spoiled ballots and they're not counted. And there's a question whether, you know, somebody looking at your signature that you've written one day and compare it to a signature that you wrote maybe a year ago is going to match. We all know that those signatures can change an awful lot. And so there's concern that people's legitimate votes are not getting counted. And while it may not be, you know, sufficient to change the outcome of an election, it's always something that's that we value as, you know, every vote should be counted.
My signature never looks the same on two separate days. I'm sure most of my ballots have been invalidated. No, I'm kidding. And there was also a bill that would have made voter registration automatic when you go in to get a driver's license. That bill didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, that's the kind of bill that our Republican-controlled legislature does not like. They think that there should be at least some effort and desire to vote to be registered. And, you know, that's kind of why they've been so strongly supportive of the caucus system. They say that people should be informed to be able to vote. And, you know, if you don't have the motivation to go inform yourself about the candidates and to participate, then maybe we don't want your vote.
Listeners, call us with your thoughts on the stories that we're covering from this past week. Thoughts on the state legislative session, 801-355-8255 is the number to call, or comment at sltrib.com. Speaking of elections, Robert Gerke, in a column that you wrote this week, you touched on the Utah Republican Party dropping its legal challenge against SB 54, the Count My Vote law that made it possible for candidates to gather signatures to get on the ballot. Instead of having to go through a party nominating convention. But according to your column, not all is as it seems.
Right. Well, the party, the state central committee of the party voted to drop the lawsuit. They had an appeal pending. Essentially, they basically just had run out of money to pay for this thing, and so they agreed to drop it. They're hoping to get some resolution on the issue of plurality, where candidates who don't get more than 50%, you know, will go into a runoff. That's what the bill that's now proposed would do. But what they also did, and nobody seemed to catch this part, was they adopted language to their bylaws that require candidates to file a certification that they will abide by, they will comply with the processes of, in the state party's constitution and bylaws. Well, those processes that are in those two documents only provide for candidates to go to the convention. So, and if the individual does not file this certification, they're stripped of their party status, and their eligibility to be a candidate shall be contested by the party. So what they've essentially done is they've eliminated that avenue to go the signature gathering route. You know, if you're a candidate who doesn't want to go to the convention and just wants to go to the signature gathering, well, then you're not complying with the party's processes, and if you don't file that certification, you can't be a candidate. So the party insists that's not what they're trying to do. They say they will comply with state law. The fact of the matter is that they haven't complied with state law yet. And James Evans says that they're not going to change their governing documents to comply with the state law because they don't want to be bullied into doing that.
Wasn't there a state Supreme Court ruling having to do with this?
The state Supreme Court said that, yes, the candidates do get to choose whether they want to go to convention or gather signatures. And then the federal court had said as well that while the party can control membership, the signature gathering route is constitutional. So, you know, they really don't have a leg to stand on. And even though they've taken this beating over and over in court, they're sort of refusing to go quietly, I guess, and really trying to do what they feel like they can do to maintain their control over the nominating process.
Chairman James Evans of the Republican Party called your account a fiction. He said that you were committing columnist malpractice.
Yes.
I received a press release on this yesterday from him. It doesn't say exactly where he questions your account,
no,
but says that your column, quote, includes scenarios which do not represent what the Utah Republican Party is doing. In the real world, we call that just making things up. He said he wouldn't even wrap a fish with this column.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll turn this away from you, Robert, to say Matt Canham, senior managing editor. Has the Tribune received any rundown of what was wrong in Gerke's piece from the Utah GOP or anything similar?
No.
All right, just checking. I had to duck in there and find that out. Dan,
well,
Dan,
you know, that's what you always have to do when somebody claims that you've. You're wrong in your reporting or in your columnizing. What you need to look at is what specifics are they pointing to, and that's the number one question. And in this case, there are no specifics, and so you know it's hard to take something seriously unless you get down to brass tacks. I just on another note on the whole SB 54 and gathering signatures. There are also quite a few efforts in the state legislature to also continue attacking SB 54. And one of them is to outlaw paid signature gathering. Now, that's a bill that's passed committee and is on the way to the floor now for a full House debate. But if they do away with the ability to use paid signature gatherers, this would eliminate a lot of the contested races because, you know, the governor, Senator Mike Lee, among others, used professional signature gatherers in the last election to get onto the primary ballot.
Okay.
Well, and I think it goes beyond the candidate signature gathering. I think this also may be targeting the ballot initiative.
Actually, it doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't.
It does not. It's only a candidate measure. Yeah.
Guys, we are running low on time, and I want to turn from elections back to other things happening up at the state legislature. Another item, Dan Harry, had to do with testing rape kits that are in the backlog of crime labs or being held by Utah police. There was an appropriations request and a bill having to do with this.
Right. And again, as I said, on a lot of these measures, it's the price tag that in the end is going to be the sticking point. Angela Romero, who's run this bill before, is trying to get all of the rape kits submitted, tested by the state, and do it within a specified time period. She cites, has brought women who are victims of rape up to testify about, you know, these rape kits being done, and it's very invasive, and, you know, and it's very traumatic for the victims, and then they only have these kits sit on the shelf for, in some cases, for years. So the measure to require all those to be tested would cost about $2.5 million. And so what I would predict will happen is that this will pass, but then it will be held on the table with all these other fiscal note bills until the end of the session. And if it gets prioritized, then it will go all the way through and the money will be in the budget.
Would it require would it mandate the testing of all rape kits, regardless of, you might have confessions, you might have people who are already in prison.
Right. But the argument is that you add to the database, and you are able, if you do that, if you build that database, you're able to identify like serial rapists who have never been charged with crimes, or whose perpetrators are not known in certain unsolved cases. And that's the value of that kind of universal testing.
Guys, we are very low on time. I wanted to turn to a quick preview of the trial against former Utah Attorney General John Swalla, which is now underway. Robert Gerke, you were there at the beginning of this story. It's come to a head now with this trial. Who's testifying this week? What's this case really about? How long is it supposed to be? And let's spend the next 2 minutes talking about that.
All right, we'll move quickly. I think this week we saw the beginning of jury selection. They did seat a jury, and they started the attorneys gave their opening statements presenting their case. I think the most significant thing we saw this week, frankly, is the defense presenting its, you know, starting to preview its defense of John Swalla, because for a long time he's been pretty silent about this stuff. We saw testimony this week from Mark Sessions Jensen, who was the businessman who entertained, I guess, Mark Shurtleff and John Swalla down at Pelican Hill. Mm-hmm. He claims they were extorting him and threatening to lock him up if he didn't cough up some money for him or give them gifts or put them up in his place. So, this is something that we've seen. You know, we've read about this. There haven't been any big bombshells or revelations, I don't think, yet, but we're seeing this case sort of starting to roll out. The charges against him, you know, they're dealing with these accepting bribes or soliciting bribes, destruction of evidence, false statements, and that sort of thing, more obstruction of justice type things that maybe are easier to prove than these bribery charges that are also hanging over him.
And we're looking at essentially a month of testimony here.
A
month-long court case.
It's 16 days. For people who want to follow this trial, because there are a lot of interesting details, we have on our website the latest from the trial each day with updates throughout the day, just little short things about what's happening in the courtroom. Jennifer Doudna is also live tweeting it, which got her a little bit in trouble at the court yesterday because she was live tweeting so well. We won. We're going to keep doing it, so you can follow that case.
Check it
step
out.
Step by step, all the way through.
At sltrib.com. Guys, we are out of time, and so we need to turn now to the final segment of the show, our underplayed stories of the week. And Robert Gerke, do you have an underplayed story?
Yeah, I think check out Brian Maffley's story today about this oil and gas lease sale by Zion National Park. Even the Washington County commissioners are opposed to it because they're concerned about the area that they're looking to drill in, and it's getting a lot of pushback from both environmental groups and from local officials.
Okay, that's Robert Gerke's. How about you, Dan Harry? Underplayed story?
I don't know if it's underplayed, but we had a story today about Orrin Hatch being honored as now the most the longest lasting Republican senator in U.S. history. And the reason he's able to claim that title was that Strom Thurmond switched parties. He was actually in the Senate for, I think, 47 years but he switched parties. And the longest serving senator actually was Robert Byrd, a Democrat, 51 years.
Wow. Well, Hatch isn't that far away now then. Matt Canham, your underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to pick one from Taylor Anderson that's in today's paper. It's about the town of Manti sold part of their main street to the LDS Church for $160,000. This block was often used by protesters during the Manti pageant, the Mormon miracle pageant that comes every year. And so there's a little bit of outcry. The ACLU is threatening to sue. This all harkens back to the selling of our part of Main Street.
A little bit of Paris.
Yeah. That's right.
All right, Matt Canhams. For my underplayed story, I'll go with interesting appropriations requests at the legislature. We've seen in past years asks for money for organizations to keep wolves out of Utah. I believe there's a big request having to do with that. Sage grouse and public lands this year, somewhere on the order of $2 million. Also a request for $500,000 for a new group that it's called FIRM, the Foundation for Integrated Resource Management, which will be working on public lands as well, including lobbying to educate the new administration in Washington. It's hard to keep up with all of the appropriations requests, but you can listen to committee meetings at the legislature's website, le.utah.gov. Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, Government Editor Dan Harry, and columnist Robert Gerke, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. Robert Kirby. Today, Kirby talks about holding on to anger after the election, and this was recorded before President Trump took office. Just after the election, you wrote an article, a column about how, you know, the election is passed, but it doesn't really matter because we're all going to hell anyways.
Yeah, in the end, we're... Everybody, you know, regardless of what faith you have, most people believe the world is going to end badly, okay? It's possible that Donald Trump is the Antichrist and that signals the end times. I don't know. But we all have a date with death. And it seems a waste of time to me to spend so much of it on anger. You know, just because things aren't going the way that you want them to go. Well, I'll tell you, it's going to come down to a point where you don't want to go, but you still got to.
And so don't look back and think of all the rage you had over the election.
Right, because there'll be that moment, if you're lucid enough when you finally pass, that you're going to go, why did I spend so much time on that crap?
Well, just going back to the going to hell part of this, you know, everybody's going to somebody else's hell.
That's right. I plan on going to my own.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah. I hope to see you there.
When you know that you're not going to make it to the very top and sit on the right hand of the Father or whatever, it takes a huge weight off your shoulders. Suddenly you don't have to stress about so much.
Advice is don't be angry. Don't drive angry, like he says in Groundhog Day.
Yeah, don't drive angry.
Don't drive angry and do good, but do it just because.
Yeah, do good because it's the right thing to do.
All right. That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and actually speaking after the election, but before President Donald Trump was inaugurated. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. You can find all of Kirby's opinions at the Kirby Archives at sltrib.com. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and to the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. And thanks to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this show at our website, kcpw.org, or through whatever you use to get podcasts on your smartphone or device. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once again for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week.
Not everybody is convinced about that whole wall thing.
I don't think it will stop anyone from coming in. I mean, that's what they did with this fence here, and people still climbing like if it was a ladder.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Border Patrol from both sides of the border, next time on Marketplace.
Join us tonight at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.